You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
Being moved to write the sonnets was an unexpected gift that I was given. I certainly didn't expect that unusual practice, but I found myself moved to sum up the wisdom in concise and distilled form just by taking notes on the daily reading that I'd done each morning after watching the sunrise. And I was surprised to learn after starting the project that many people who read this wisdom during the founding era were also moved to write sonnets, including Phyllis Wheatley, the great poet, Mercy Otis Warren, Alexander Hamilton, and John Quincy Adams, who would read the Tusculan Disputations in the original and read Cicero in the original in the White House for consolation, write sonnets and watch the sunrise and walk along the Potomac. You quoted in your introduction that idea of planting seeds for future generations, and that passage came from the Tusculan Disputations, and Adams adopted it as his own motto. There's something especially empowering about Cicero, which after all is a manual on grief. And it's very striking that Adams and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and so many in the founding era viewed this manual about overcoming grief as the definition for achieving happiness. I think it's because it's a philosophy of self-mastery, self-improvement, and self-empowerment. I was moved to organize the book according to 12 virtues by noting the incredible synchronicity that both Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson made lists of 12 or 13 virtues for achieving happiness. And I knew about Franklin's famous system for achieving moral perfection, which he writes about in his autobiography, where he made a list of 13 virtues for self-mastery. But I was just struck by the coincidence of seeing on the wall of the Boar's Head Inn in Charlottesville, Virginia, on the UVA campus, a list of 12 virtues that Jefferson had drafted for his daughters. And they were almost identical to Franklin's. And the fact that both had chosen these 12 virtues seemed like a natural organizing principle for the book. And then, of course, I wanted to tell the stories through people because that's the best way to relate to an attempt to practice self-mastery, to see how people achieved it in their own lives. And then I just chose different founders to associate with different virtues. It seemed like a good way of telling the stories through their lives' journeys. Well, it's important that although you can disaggregate them, they're really clusters of the same quest. They're all glosses on the four classical virtues of temperance, prudence, courage, and justice. And they're all attempts to achieve self-mastery. And in that sense, tranquility, moderation, these are different ways of expressing the ideas of prudence and temperance. It's striking that Adam Smith translated the Roman word temperantia, or temperance, with virtue as a kind of tranquility of the soul. And when I tried to practice the Franklin 13 virtues, which I did a couple years ago at the recommendation of a rabbi who suggested the Hebrew version, a Hasidic rabbi in the 19th century had translated Franklin's virtues into Hebrew, and a friend and I tried to practice them without actually knowing that they came from Franklin. I found that separating them or disaggregating them, as Franklin recommends, focusing on temperance one week, for example, and industry another, is less successful than thinking of them holistically. Really practicing the virtues, it's more of a vibe than a checklist. And in that sense, it's a feeling of alignment, harmony, balance, tranquility, self-mastery that you achieve once you've internalized the wisdom. So that was my experience, but we could certainly talk about individual virtues, which are, of course, a great way to try to achieve the state that Franklin recommended. The pandemic was crucial. I don't think I would have been moved to set aside 2 hours in the morning for deep reading without the fact that we were all at home. I sort of felt the license to try an unusual project, which led in all sorts of unexpected places. But the takeaway, if I can be so reductionistic, was that the habits of deep reading are themselves the most tangible expression of the virtues. And in that sense, the virtue of industry is the one that I take with me still. So many of the founders did too. They fell short of so many virtues, as we all do every day, but it was the habits of deep reading and writing and also of keeping up a consistent daily schedule. Yes, slavery is the most glaring, notorious, and important hypocrisy to discuss. How was it possible that these founders, all of whom acknowledged that slavery violated natural rights and natural justice, themselves owned slaves? And it was striking to discover that they didn't even try. That Patrick Henry quote is so significant. He said, "Is it not amazing that I myself, who believe that slavery is immoral, myself own slaves? I will not justify it. I won't attempt to. It's simple avarice or greed. I can't do with the inconvenience of living without them." And that idea that these men who insisted that virtues like industry and frugality were so important and that avarice or ambition were such sins themselves just couldn't be bothered to give up the lifestyle. It was indeed their addiction to the ease that enslavement made possible that led to this hypocrisy. It's striking that they viewed this hypocrisy in classical terms and also that they didn't attempt to justify it and were reminded that the pursuit of happiness is indeed a pursuit. It's not a place that anyone expects to arrive at, because to arrive at the final destination would mean to achieve moral perfection. Madison hopes that a class of enlightened journalists he calls the literati, which is a phrase he gets from Condorcet, will, by writing complicated arguments like the Federalist Papers and the newspapers, slowly educate and refine public opinion. Many have lost the habits of deep reading that are really necessary for the experiment to survive. The founders thought it was imperative that people seek out information, listen to arguments from different perspectives, deliberate with their fellow citizens before making up their own mind. That crucial right is also a duty to think as you will and speak as you think, as Jefferson said, quoting from Tacitus's famous defense of free speech. And when people substitute their own duty to make up their own mind with partisanship, where they just adopt the opinions of the most mobilized extremes, that really is a serious threat to the entire experiment. The idea of being moved by opinion rather than fact and expressing allegiance to an ideology rather than being open-minded to evidence is the definition of a faction. A faction is any group, either a majority or a minority, animated by passion rather than reason, devoted to self-interest rather than the public good. And that's exactly what the algorithmic rabbit holes and filter bubbles and echo chambers encourage, and it's a serious threat. And it's a sign of their willingness to follow the truth wherever it may lead, not to rest on ideology or to be stuck in current politics, but to continue to learn and grow and note the similarities and differences among traditions. It was significant that Jefferson at the end of his life said, "I've given up newspapers for Tacitus." And it's an inspiration, I think, that when all of us become old, we can find learning and growth in the wisdom of the past rather than being caught up in current controversies. Yes, the wise restraints that make us free, a formulation at Harvard Law School, or Brandeis loved to quote Goethe, "In limits we the limitless explore." I love the Leonard Bernstein quotation from his Young People's Concerts about how Beethoven's choice of a single note in the Eroica mirrors the choice of wise restraints in a democracy. And Bernstein says that freedom is not limitless autonomy like some hippies like to think. It's the ability to make wise choices that will best allow us to serve society as a whole. I love Bernstein's excitement in talking about how he says for Beethoven, was he the best harmonist? No. Was it his orchestral abilities? Absolutely not. It was just that each note that he chose was exactly the right note to follow the note that preceded it, as if he had a telephone wire to God, and that he was channeling the note that created and mirrored the divine harmonies of the universe. And it was so striking to see John Adams compare the harmonies of a great piece by Handel to the harmonies of the state. And harmony is truth, which is reason, which is the divine, according to the classical authority. And we have not only a right, but a duty to live according to reason in order to align ourselves with the divine harmonies of the universe. And that's why seeking that kind of harmony through art and nature is as important or more important than trying to achieve harmony through politics. The quest for individual and collective self-mastery is really a search for harmony. When I was rereading the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, I was struck by the idea of the environmental crisis being a kind of self-executing divine retribution for disturbing the harmonies of the universe. There's so many passages in the scripture which talk about the plagues and fires and punishments that come from failing to respect our place in the universe and having the hubris to imagine that we can transform and thwart the laws of nature. And these punishments are self-executing, and we are experiencing them. And the way to restore the harmony is the way that harmony has always been restored, which is by restraint and humility and living according to nature. There's no more empowering act for me than simply turning the devices off. The simple rule that I'm not allowed to browse in the morning until I've done my reading has opened up worlds. And so much of tech and the net are designed to capture our attentions, to turn us into consumers rather than citizens, to fan our basest passions and emotions and send us down rabbit holes, that the best thing we can do is to turn it off. The pictures in our minds, I guess that was Walter Lippmann, are confirmed by the Enlightenment empiricists like John Locke, who insists that our reality is shaped by our external sensations and what we put into our minds. And then the great injunction that my dad used to quote from Paracelsus, as we imagine ourselves to be, so shall we be. So it's so important to exercise autonomous self-control over the pictures and images that we put into our minds. And the best thing we can do is to turn them off. I'm so grateful to these teachers every day. They're with me every day. My father, great hypnotherapist and guru, who died at 95, just as I was finishing the book, was with me at every stage. And his empowering message that as we imagine ourselves to be, so shall we be, helped me see the connections between the hypnotherapy that he practiced and the great wisdom traditions. My superb teachers at the Dalton School in New York, where I went to high school in English, Hortense Tyroller, Michael Berthold, history, Jeffrey Gunn, Paul Poet, chemistry, Margot Gunport, so importantly kindled in me this love of reading and learning. And then in college, I just had the extraordinary privilege of studying with great humanists in history and literature. Walter Jackson Bate wrote the towering biography of Samuel Johnson and taught the age of Johnson, insisted that the humanities could be put to use and could teach us how to live. And through his love of poetry and prose of the 18th century, both taught me how to write and hear the music and language, and also inspired in me this urgent belief in the necessity of the humanities to teach us how to live.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.